And a warm welcome to Afternoons with me, Bill Arnold. Thank you for joining me today. Just going to encourage you to try to do something really nice for somebody today. Think about someone who would really benefit from a phone call or a little message from you, a little letting them know that you're thinking of them. I think it's increasingly more important as we are in a very stressful time that we are making contact and we're reaching out and letting people know we care about them and think about them and love them, and really goes a long way. So my day is going to be good, and I've got here's what I got planned for you. I'm going to have Rob Louie on in just a second, and then Dr. Daniel Taylor will be joining me in the second part of the hour, and then a full hour with Dr. John Woodward. So it's going to be great. I can't wait. Rob Louie is, of course, the executive editor of the Daily Signal, and he's with us right now on our studio line. Rob, welcome.
It's great to be back, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Of course, and you know that there's virtually nothing going on in the news right now, so I don't know what we're going to do for the next 20 minutes.
I'm not sure, but you know what? I'm glad you started the show off the way you did, because that was great advice, and I'm going to personally take it and encourage all of your listeners to do the same. So thank you, and especially on a busy news day like this, and not exactly a news day that that there's a lot to celebrate. The 200,000th death to yes. COVID-19 just being reported by Johns Hopkins today. So obviously a grim day in our history, a milestone that certainly no one looked forward to. And 6 months after all those lockdowns, you know, we still find ourselves in a situation where you know, we are praying for that vaccine and something to stop this.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the landscape of the election and everything else has changed pretty dramatically in the last 4 days.
It certainly has, and ahead of next Tuesday's debate, so there's a lot to certainly unpack when Chris Wallace has the two candidates on stage. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, is somebody who was highly respected for the work she did not only on the Supreme Court, but before she made it to the court. She was respected and admired by the American people, and I think you've heard that people pay tribute to her across the political aisle. But no sooner did they do that than we were already finding ourselves in a debate about what comes next. And it's a little bit sad that we can't have a little bit more time to mourn. But, you know, this is Washington in 2020, after all. So the partisan bickering consumes most of the attention right away. And you're absolutely correct. Mitt Romney coming out today saying that he thinks the Senate should vote mm-hmm. on a nominee before the election. So that means that Republicans likely will have the votes to confirm a nominee. The big question is, who is that going to be? And will that person be somebody who is given the treatment that, say, like a Ruth Bader Ginsburg received in 1993 mm-hmm. or what Brett Kavanaugh had to endure a couple of years ago?
No kidding. There's the big difference. I mean, who wants to put themselves through that kind of scrutiny? I mean, it's great to be scrutinized for your work and your history, but they get awfully personal. They did with Brett Kavanaugh in a way that was not fair.
Yes, you'll absolutely are correct on that. And you'll remember that it really caused some hard feelings in Washington. I'll never forget that moment that Lindsey Graham from the dais, you know, criticized his Democratic colleagues for dragging Kavanaugh through the mud and what he and his family had to endure. Mm-hmm. And of course, the fact that it happened so late in the process, you might remember that we were actually, you know, coming up to a vote on Kavanaugh, and then all of a sudden, you know, this news breaks and everything was delayed. And so, you know, it's a situation that I hope we can avoid. Certainly Republicans want to move quickly. If they're going to do so, they'll have to do so in a very condensed period of time to have both the Judiciary Committee hearing on the nominee and then a floor vote. The Democrats can employ some tactics to try to delay that to carry it past or later into October. But obviously a lot is at stake. You know, this is a seat on the Supreme Court that doesn't belong to either party. We should remind mm-hmm. your listeners, the Constitution doesn't say that there needs to be a certain number of Republican appointees and Democratic appointees. In fact, Ruth Bader Ginsburg replaced somebody who was more on the conservative side of the spectrum. So, you know, this is one of those instances where there could be a fundamental shift in the court. Republicans see it as a 4-4 landscape right now. John Roberts often siding with the left mm-hmm. on some of the big social issues, we'll see, Bill. It's a lot hanging in the balance here as President Trump weighs his decision.
And Rob, anyone who says yes to the nomination must be up for the fight of their life. I mean, they're going to be picked over, and it's going to be so ugly. I mean, when I saw what happened to Kavanaugh, and then now times two, what's going to happen to this next person, it's the whole thing saddens me, really.
It is sad that that this is what it comes down to. Heritage Foundation President Kay James, who you recently had on the program, wrote an outstanding piece for FoxNews.com looking at how this all began and where we started to deteriorate. You really can – it didn't go back too far in our own lifetime. I mean, it was Robert Bork's nomination in 1987 and then of Clarence Thomas's nomination a couple of years later, where you really saw this escalate. It tends to happen more so on the left than it does on the right. Even President Clinton's two nominees for the Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, both had over 60 votes, so bipartisan approval. For some reason, though, and I think it's probably because the left sees so much of their agenda being tied to Supreme Court decisions, they are very passionate about this, and that's why you've seen some people resort to threats. They showed up outside of the homes of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and Senator Lindsey Graham, who leads the Judiciary Committee, making threats to them, literally the mob out in force. And you know, it's really sad that it's come to that. I'm all for peaceful protests, but when you're threatening people's lives, when you're threatening to burn down the Capitol, threatening destruction on our institutions, I think it's gone too far, Bill. And I hope that people can calm down and let the process play out. This is the Constitution we're following, after all. And I know people don't like it and they want things to happen a certain way. As the old saying is, elections do have consequences. And Republicans did expand their majority in the Senate in 2018. And President Trump was duly elected in 2016.
So, Rob, when we put this factor this into the election in the next 40 days, how is this going to both bases are going to be very energized by this. How does this change and who does this give an advantage to?
It's really hard to say because there are so many individual races. Like, for instance, there are some Republican senators who are in really tight races. And I don't know who that benefits, to be honest with you. In the past, what we do know is that conservative voters tend to be more motivated by these judicial nominees than those on the left. We saw that in particular when George W. Bush was the president and Democrats started to block some of his nominees for lower courts. And they really use that as a motivating factor to get people out to vote and support President Bush, who didn't, by the way, get any Supreme Court nominations until his second term, you'll remember. It didn't happen until, I think, 2005. Look, the fact that Ruth Bader Ginsburg tended to side with liberals more often, maybe they will be more motivated. But I also think that there are a fair number of conservatives who don't necessarily like the personal politics of Donald Trump, who voted for him simply because they saw so much at stake with the Supreme Court. And let's remember that Donald Trump has done something that his predecessors haven't done, and that's to release a list of candidates for the Supreme Court. He did this both in 2016, and he just did it earlier this month. That's something that others have not done, including his competitor in this race. So we shall see if that is a motivating factor. People know who President Trump would pick. And we've done some stories looking into the bios of the women, because he said it will be a woman who could end up in that seat.
Mm. Rob, would you give us a little history lesson on the riots of today versus the riots of, say, 40, 50 years ago?
Well, sure, absolutely. I think that it's important to always look back at history, if for no other reason than how can we learn to be better stewards of our country today if we don't learn from some of those lessons in the past. And I think you're referring to the riots of the 1960s, which were very much tied to two things in particular. One was the Vietnam War. There was a strong opposition to Vietnam, which was motivating this anti-war movement at the time. In fact, it became so bad that Lyndon Johnson was unable to leave the White House at times. And of course, race factored into it, much like it does today. There was a big push during that period of time. There was, of course, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and some constitutional amendments. So you saw a situation where there was intensity that seems to to be similar to today, but I'd point out that there are a couple of important distinctions. And so just as that movement kind of dissipated with Richard Nixon's election from the so-called quiet majority, I think that the difference today is you have some real strong institutions that are bankrolling and funding these movements. And you see that specifically with the Black Lives Matter movement. You see that with efforts like the 1619 Project from the New York Times. And as you look at some of the funders from the Ford Foundation and other organizations, what they're trying to ultimately do is radically change our country. And that's why so much is at stake, frankly, in this election. And it's so important that regardless of what you do, that you do get out and vote. And your listeners do that as well. And so back to the differences, though, Bill, I think that you know, in the 1960s, yes, it was about protesting certain things, whether it be Vietnam or making sure that we had racial equality. Today, it seems that they want to fundamentally transform our country. They want to do away with the Constitution. And we just celebrated Constitution Day last Thursday. And it really alarms me that so many people say that the Constitution is outdated, that we need to, reimagine our country. No, we don't. This is a country of great hope and opportunity. And think about all of the good fortune that we've had in America that others across the globe haven't had. And it's because of the Constitution, which is, you know, the oldest charter document of any nation that is in existence today.
Mm-hmm. Rob Blue is my guest, of course, the executive editor at the Daily Signal. Head over to dailysignal.com. That's dailysignal.com. Learn all about Rob and his colleagues and the brilliant reporting they do. We'll be right back. I'm back with Rob Bluey, executive editor at the Daily Signal, learning about what's going on in Washington, D.C. Rob, some of the press seems to be cooperating with the Marxist roots of the Black Lives Matter organizations. What's going on with that?
Yes, well, there's a couple of things that I think your listeners should know about. First and foremost, the 1619 Project, which in many cases is tied right in very closely with a lot of these efforts, it was spearheaded by the New York Times. And so it gave these groups an opportunity to start to have this conversation, and which in many ways goes to what we were just talking about, fundamentally transforming our country, reimagining it, not only starting in 1776, but predating it to 1619 when slaves first arrived in Jamestown, Virginia. And so I think that there is a close association, but also, we've also really taken to the New York Times to task recently because my colleague Mike Gonzalez did some outstanding investigative reporting to find out that there are some clear ties between some pro-communist Chinese groups and the founder of Black Lives Matter. Mm. And as we all know from previous conversations, the Black Lives Matter group, up until recently, scrubbing its website, was very explicit in some of its pro-Marxist beliefs, including things like doing away with the nuclear family, which we know is obviously just a silly way to go about any raising any family. I mean, the nuclear family is kind of the origin for what makes you successful in so many instances. So, Bill, it's an ongoing challenge, but we're going to continue to point out where the media is flawed. It's another reason why I think that the work you're doing at Faith Radio, the work we're doing at the Daily Signal is so important, because there need to be alternative sources of news out there that the American people can tune into. We're fortunate to live in a time when the internet provides so many opportunities for conservatives, for Christians, for others to start their own news operations. And that's exactly what we did 6 years ago at the Daily Signal and why we're still doing it today.
Yeah, and you're doing it so well. Another really interesting article at the Daily Signal by Victor Davis Hanson about news media and how it died of self-inflicted wounds.
Yes, well, Victor Davis Hanson is certainly somebody that we look to, and his advice is always so timely and interesting. So this particular column that he writes goes through some examples of just how conflicted it can be, the news media can be, in terms of its treatment of different individuals. I think we've talked about this in the past. You know, how can certain people like Andrew Cuomo of New York and Gavin Newsom of California get such flattering coverage from the news media, while others like Greg Abbott of Texas and Ron DeSantis of Florida, you know, come under such harsh attacks? And you, I don't even think this example was in Victor Davis Hanson's column, but what a startling example to look at the Washington Post's front page on Saturday, where there was a glowing article about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm not saying that there shouldn't have been, but when you compare that to 2016 and their coverage of Antonin Scalia, the headlines couldn't have been more opposed to each other. A critical headline of Scalia and his views, and a praising rendition of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So I think it's really important for us to pay attention to this, particularly in this moment that we're in now. You'll remember back, the presidential debates are going to be a critical period of time. And what we really need to hope for is that these moderators who come out of some of these media institutions really give them an opportunity to speak to directly to the voters and not intervene in a way that Candy Crowley did in that famous debate where she shut down Mitt Romney when he tried to question President Obama about things like Benghazi. So, yes, the news media can put its weight on the scale, and in too many times it has, and too many times it's failed.
Mm-hmm. Robin, when you mentioned back about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Judge Scalia, I'm starting to think again about how fast can the Senate move? How long do you think this process will take, and do you think it would be done prior to the election?
I do think that it will happen prior to the election. So let's President Trump has said Friday or Saturday he will be likely making a decision. I know that there's news reports today that he's going to Florida on Friday and he'll meet with one of the candidates at that point. So let's just say Saturday an announcement comes. You know, the Senate will obviously have to begin some of its steps. There's a background questionnaire and various things that the committee goes through. So I don't think that you'll probably see anything before the week of, say, like, the first week of full week of October. And at that point, you know, that week of October 5th, you know, there will be, you know, movements. They'll probably have at least a week's worth of hearings. Usually what they do is have a couple of days questioning for the nominee, a couple of days from other people to give their experience and recommendations or criticism of that particular nominee. So, you know, that'll go on for a week. The Senate will probably take several days to debate this on the floor. So, yes, it can definitely be done by November 3rd. It is a tight schedule, though. I'm not sure that since Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed in 42 days, we've seen something quite like this. But the Senate has moved quickly in the past. Sandra Day O'Connor was confirmed unanimously, relatively quickly, under 3 weeks. There was even one Supreme Court nominee way back in the day who was confirmed in a single day, I believe, during FDR's term. So I don't think it'll be that quick, Bill.
That's a busy day.
But you know, we know how slow things tend to move in Washington, but there's no reason to delay. And in particular, because I think it's so critically important that we have 9 people serving on the court when Election Day does happen. You know, we think back to Bush v. Gore, which was a 5-4 decision that settled that election.
Right.
I think it's really important that we have a full court when it comes to Election Day, because we've already talked about so many times in the past the concerns about mail-in voting, the fact that there will be lawsuits disputing election results. Those cases could very well find themselves at the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about what you and your colleagues around the Daily Signal are saying regards to the first upcoming presidential debate happening Tuesday night.
Well, we are excited about it. I think these debates are always an opportunity to focus on some of the big policy issues, look at the candidates' records. And we've already heard from Chris Wallace, who is the moderator, Chris Wallace of Fox News, on some of the topics that he plans to address. I don't think it'll come as any surprise to your listeners that COVID-19 will probably be a centerpiece of what's discussed. Wallace also said he's going to ask them about economic policy, racism, and the integrity of the election, as well as the Supreme Court. So those are all things that you can expect to hear Joe Biden and Donald Trump discuss. And of course, you know, I think that in part because of what's happened because of COVID-19, there's more at stake with the debates this year than perhaps in the past. And so there will be a total of four debates, three presidential debates, including one vice presidential debate between Mike Pence and Kamala Harris. So much to happen over the course of the month, and we're excited for them to get started.
Yeah. How much violence do you anticipate our country looking at in the next 3 months, 2 months?
Well, I certainly hope and pray that we won't be having any violence, but I think based on what we've seen this summer, you know, there's a likelihood for it to happen. I was in Washington, D.C. today. I was pleased to see that some of the buildings that had boarded up have taken down the plywood and appear to be resuming more normal operations from the time that the protests had really overtaken the city. But as we saw in Kenosha, Wisconsin, look, these things can pop up at any moment, and it's really unpredictable where things will happen. Maybe because we're headed back into cooler weather, people are back in school, but college and you know, elementary and high school, you know, maybe, you know, things will not be as intense as they were this summer, Bill. But I think that there's still a lot of people who are out of work. They're frustrated with the situation they find themselves in with COVID-19. And yes, we need to be mindful that that there are things of great concern. And if the election doesn't go a certain way for people who might be on the losing side of it, I think that, yes, they may well resort to more violence. But, Bill, it's very hard to understand sometimes what's motivating these things. That's why I think that we need to keep doing this investigative reporting, and we're going to continue to pursue it. Who's behind these types of things? We know that George Soros, for instance, is funding a lot of these prosecutors who aren't prosecuting the criminals who are perpetrating the violence. And the American people deserve to know about that. And that's why we're committed to doing the type of journalism that we do at The Daily.
Yeah. So bottom line, I think we need to continue with lots of prayer. And also just to remind each other to be kind and to maybe extend an act of kindness to someone that you know that could really benefit from hearing from you today. So, Rob, thanks so much for doing the show, as always.
Thank you, Bill.
Always
great to be with you.
Yeah, thank you. Rob Bluey has been my guest. Of course, he is the executive editor at the Daily Signal. I promise if you go over to dailysignal.com and check it out, you'll bookmark it and you'll go there regularly. The reporting is excellent. The articles are very interesting. These podcasts are available there, and you can learn a lot and get a nice, truthful interpretation of the news over at dailysignal.com. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, Dr. Daniel Taylor will be joining me. He's written a book called The Skeptical Believer. He's also great at helping you tell your story. Let's touch on both. Be back in a minute. So glad to get a chance to chat again with Dr. Daniel Taylor. He's an American writer, author of 9 books. He's also a professor. You do a lot of cool stuff. What do you, hand signals? I can't count that fast.
14 books.
14 books.
I've been busy.
All right. So nice work. 14 books. You know, remind my audience about all the things that you have done in the past. Professor, theologian,
writer. Yeah, I was a professor for almost 40 years of literature and writing. And so these books range from everything from sort of low-grade apologetics to books on premature babies and on Irish saints. And the last 10 years I've been writing novels, and I have a series of novels.
Yeah, now we've had a chance to chat about your book, The Skeptical Believer,
right?
Telling Stories to Your Inner Atheist. I thought that was a fascinating read.
Thank you.
No, I enjoyed that a lot. But you just finished another novel. And it's going to be coming out in a while, maybe next summer, maybe?
Maybe never. It depends on what the editor says about it. But he's accepted 3 others, so I'm just counting on him to, out of habit, accept this one.
Give me his name. I'll take care of stuff. I'll take care of it.
Okay.
You'll get your novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you write, who do you think of as your audience?
Well, you know, I have a shorter answer and a longer answer. My shorter answer is kindred spirits.
Okay, I like that.
And I don't know who they are or where they are.
Okay.
And based on my sales, there's not a heck of a lot of them either. But I write with the faith, I guess you would say, that there are people who share my values and my curiosities and are attracted enough to how I think and write about those things to want to read some of the stuff I've written. So, you get emails from people who sort of announce themselves as kindred spirits, maybe a couple a week, who encourage you to keep plotting and typing away. And then my larger answer, with a little bit of trepidation, is the cloud of witnesses. I do feel a responsibility for those who've gone before, and that's more than just the cloud of witnesses that Hebrews 12 is talking about. It includes, you know, the history of faith and people who have shaped me and who I've profited from, you know, some of them writers, some of them thinkers, some of them just people of service. And so I think I want to use whatever skills I have to be faithful to a tradition that they have established.
Mm-hmm. I got a copy of your book, Creating a Spiritual Legacy, and I took a speed reading course. So I am reading 24% faster, but my comprehension rate is down 24%.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a wash.
I'm the perfect writer for you. I'm all volume.
Yeah, exactly. And The Skeptical Believer is a great book. And the very first book of yours I ever got was Letters to My Children.
Yeah. And that was the second book I wrote, and it was written at a time when I was younger and had hair, and my kids, my first three, the fourth one came along right at the end of when I was writing that book and got the last letter. But they were young, between the ages of about 5 and 9, and I had this realization that even though I was a young father, there was no guarantee I was going to be here to see my kids grow up. So, and I, you know, we've had, my wife's father died when she was 15, so we, and I have no people whose father or mother passed away soon. So I wanted to say some things in that book that I might not be there to say as they grew up if they were asking questions.
Or... Yeah, so a little sideline here, Daniel, because I want to get back to a couple of other things I have on the on my question list, but encourage some listeners right now to do exactly what you did. Write some words down for your maybe your grandkids or even your kids.
Yeah, I think this book that you referred to, Creating a Spiritual Legacy, I think one of the key components of a legacy should be our stories. And they're the stories of success and failure. They're the stories of what God has done in our lives and maybe stories of when God seemed too far away. It's a way we bless our kids and our grandkids by putting some of them down. And it doesn't require you to be any kind of writer. I say if I had a story from my great-grandfather, would I worry about the punctuation? You know, would I worry about the grammar? No, I would just prize that this ancestor, long gone, is speaking to me over the years, over the decades, and telling me something about his or her life. So I wrote that book, Creating a Spiritual Legacy, in order to kind of give some hands-on advice about how to do that.
If we feel God is absent, is that a sign of his presence?
A sign of his presence? I don't know if I'd want to go that far.
Okay. When you were talking,
when I think about that situation, I think about Christ on the cross and his feeling that God was absent or had rejected him. And yet, the doctrine of the Trinity tells us that the three parts of the Trinity are so intimately interrelated that I think the Bible, I don't want to overstate this, but I think the Bible teaches God the Father was on the cross too. And that Jesus simply could not, at that moment, bearing the sins of the world, perceive him, perceive his presence. And I think it's sometimes that way for us. It's not that God is absent, although people like to write about an absent or a hidden God, mm-hmm. it's that for whatever life circumstances, we don't feel that at this moment. And I think the challenge is to hang in there, to persevere until that relationship is palpable to us again.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, when you wrote The Skeptical Believer, did you find that there were a lot of people that would push back against things that they would hear, cliches that they would hear? People that say, what does that mean? I mean, don't we at a certain level as believers, we start to just adopt phraseology
yeah.
without really knowing what it means?
Yeah. Well, of course, they didn't find a single cliche in my book. But
nor did I.
Nor did you.
Yes, no.
And if you thought you did, you were mistaken.
I went over it carefully, too. Didn't
no,
find
that, I mean, that's one of the standing challenges, I guess, of faith is that we tend to tame it. And one of the ways we tame it is by turning it into cliches and formulas and easy answers to difficult questions, et cetera. And some people are fairly comfortable with that, maybe even build ministries on that. And other people, too much of that will drive them from the community of faith altogether. So part of what that book is trying to do is to move beyond cliches and formulas and easy answers without suggesting that somehow I'm inventing new truths, but maybe fresh ways to think about old truths.
Yeah, because if you hear new expressions, you're going to wonder, is this person trying to come up with a new truth? And I think what you were doing is expressing things in a fresh way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Bible tells us there's nothing new under the sun. That is in the
right.
Bible, isn't it?
That's in the Bible, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's true of human nature. And, you know, I don't think human nature has changed much since Adam and Eve. And, the truths about God, which we, of course, only understand partially, don't change from day to day. So, but sometimes the way we talk about them gets stale or no longer helpful. And so it can be valuable to put new words onto old truths.
Mm-hmm. Does doubt and faith and certainty, can those all be expressed in the same sentence?
Yeah. Yeah, I think doubt is a necessary component of faith myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if you have certainty, you don't need faith. I don't need to be certain that 2 + 2, I don't need to have faith to know that 2 + 2 = 4. It is because our knowledge is partial and because of the stresses of life that we need faith in places where our reason cannot, for instance, fully adjudicate the situation or speak into our situation or give us the answers we would like to have. So that I think that there's a sort of a force field between those three terms and they interrelate. What I don't think is that certainty is the key to faith, or that if you don't have certainty, you don't have faith, because I think so often in Scripture, people are operating without certainty, even about what God wants or who God is or
mm-hmm.
all kinds of
situations. You have a situation. Quick example that pops
into
your head?
I knew you were going to ask that.
I know, sorry about that. We go to break
that.
And give you a few minutes to think about it.
Well, the prophets, for instance, things, you know, are falling apart, and they're trying to speak what God has told them to speak, and they're mm-hmm. getting bashed for it, and sometimes even their lives threatened for it. And so Elijah runs away from Jezebel and sits under a plant in the heat and wants to die.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so is this a guy with certainty and everything's just hunky-dory for him? Not at all. He's at sea. But then God comes in a still small voice and speaks to him.
Mm-hmm. So talk about emotions and how you think emotions help our faith or hurt our faith.
Well, I'll quote one of my favorite writers, Pascal, says the heart has its reasons which reason does not understand. And the emotions are as much a part of God's creation as any other part of us, physical, intellectual, you know, will, all of these different parts of us. So any faith that does not include the emotions is not fully, I don't want to overstate it again, but not fully faith in my view, because you're leaving a part of your life out
True.
Of it.
Yeah.
So God speaks to our emotions. God uses our emotions. Love is an emotion, and we are comfortable saying that that's the essential characteristic of God. But obviously, everything is fallen. So there's no, creation is good, but there's no part of creation which is not touched by the fall. And so our emotions can mislead us, can tell us untruths, can block us from God rather than inviting God. So it's like any other part of the human condition. It can operate for good or for ill.
Mm-hmm. When I think of the weeping of Jesus, when I think of all the occasions where there was intense emotional occurrences in Scripture, I think, well, emotions are a powerful part of our faith story. And
right.
I remember thinking that whether I feel emotional about something or not regarding my faith, God's promised it, so I believe it.
Yeah.
And that's where I sometimes go, well, what? How much is emotions important or not important? It's always confusing to me.
Well, I think it is important, and it can obviously be exaggerated. I find that my emotions rise most often through music, not through preaching.
Okay.
So I often feel closest to God when I'm singing hymns in company with my community. So we together are rehearsing the story of faith in music. In hymns, especially, of course, I'm old, so the old hymns mean most to me. And I can get emotional singing certain hymns, and part of it, you could say, well, that's sentimentality because you remember singing that when you were a kid at your little fundamentalist church. And of course, that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's because music operates at that line, I think, between transcendence and immanence, between a transcendent spiritual world and the physical world. We produce music physically with our throats and with instruments, but it takes our spirit to a place where God often can reveal himself to us more clearly than when we're trying to be smart and figure things out.
Mm-hmm. Silent Night on Christmas Eve is a three Kleenex song for me.
Yeah. Well, and it does depend on that context,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
There are other times when Silent Night wouldn't move you at all.
No, but...
But in that context,
yeah, I'm
it
gone.
Does, yeah.
I'm
well,
gone.
In these novels I'm writing, I almost always have one or two hymns or songs. It just occurred to the narrator from his childhood. He was raised in faith as a Baptist, and he's run away from it, and he's kind of slowly working his way back toward it. But he'll have hymns come to him or Bible passages that he had to memorize in junior high to earn points to get taken to McDonald's, and then they come back to him in a haunting kind of way at key moments, and he doesn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
So these, there's nothing that's lost.
Yeah. So a shout out to all the Awana teachers that are
helping
the second graders memorize Scripture. That's all part of it. Let me take a little break, if you don't mind. Dr.
Sure.
Daniel Taylor is my guest. We'll be right back. We're back with Dr. Daniel Taylor, author of how many books again, Dan?
14. Depends if I did 10 years on a Bible translation, and I'm counting that as a book.
I even think you should.
I don't put it on my resume as author of the Bible.
Yeah. Well, I've got three of your books, so I'm interested in hearing something you said. Again, tell my listeners about comment you made about an author who talked about the first things you memorize.
Well, picking up on this idea of memories and how they last, this woman claimed, and I think correctly, that the first things you memorize as a child are the last things you forget as your mind declines at the end of life. And that was an argument in her mind for scripture memory for children. And you mentioned Awana's, fill your mind with not just the values and ideas of scripture, but with the actual words of scripture, and they will stay with you and will be there after you can no longer tell time.
Wow.
And I would say the same about hymns, which we talked about, singing hymns with my mom, who was very deep in Alzheimer's, but we would sing Blessed Assurance together, and it was a sweet time, and all those hymns were still in her brain, even though she much else had left.
Yeah, I've got a lovely video of a dear friend of mine singing along while his mother plays piano.
Oh,
she's 90.
Yeah.
And they're both singing their hearts out, and she doesn't even know who he is.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But they're just in harmony, singing away and having the best old time.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It's just the sweetest thing ever. All right, let's go back to writing. Talk about writing. Tell me the difference between you writing fiction and nonfiction. You've done both, right?
I have, and I mostly wrote nonfiction up until 10 years ago. Well, actually, I started writing fiction maybe 20 years ago, but more seriously, 10. Well, if you read books about it, people make clear distinctions between it. They say, for instance, if you're writing fiction, show, don't tell. In other words, if somebody's angry, don't say he's angry. You know, describe him, his eyes bulging and his nostrils flaring, blah, blah, blah. And obviously in nonfiction, you're allowed more to tell directly, propositionally, what's true or what you want to get across. But my experience is that in many ways they're similar. First off, just needing to write well, you know, that's the first challenge in both genres. But I use a lot of stories in my nonfiction. But the stories in my nonfiction are from my life or somebody else's life. And in some ways, that's easier than writing fiction. Because if you're telling a story from your own life, even though you might be embroidering it or who knows, it's a kind of a parameters. It's sort of a fence. You have to wander within this fence and the story. You know where the story is going and how it's going to end and all that. In fiction, you can literally do anything, which is a kind of freedom, but it also can be paralyzing. Like, this character could die, this character could live, this character could succeed or fail. And so that's a difference that I feel. But basically, I feel in both fiction and nonfiction, you have a duty to language, you have a duty to trying to write skillfully. You have a duty to your reader to say something worth reading. And you also have a duty to that cloud of witnesses we talked about before.
Mm-hmm. So when you face challenges as a Christian writing fiction in a secular world, how do you process that?
Well, first off, it is a challenge, and it's one that I accept because you know, I think there are challenges for the Christian writer, both from the broader culture and from the Christian community. From the broader culture, they simply, for the most part, in the last 50, maybe even up to 100 years, have eliminated the religious experience from storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many novels in the last 50 years have taken seriously characters who have faith? And sometimes they'll slip in as people to caricature or make fun of, but very rarely, only occasionally, a handful of writers would treat them seriously. Flannery O'Connor would be an example,
mm-hmm.
who is herself a Christian writer. So I think there's this vast opportunity to write about faith to a culture that is oblivious to it. So I have a sermon in each one of these four novels, at least one sermon, a church service. And I have, as I said, I have hymns that show up. Now, this has the potential of putting these people off and publishers off, like, you know, nobody goes there, let's not. So that's why you have to write skillfully and engagingly in order to overcome that prejudice. As far as the community of faith goes, too often, they want sentimentality or didacticism. So they want, and by didacticism, I simply mean they want clear theological truths clearly portrayed and in ways that do move the heart. And those, both didacticism and sentimentality, tend to be the enemies of good fiction. So how do you write about ultimate truths, the truths of God, of Scripture, and all these kind of things in a way that isn't sappy or just a kind of like a Sunday school lesson?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big challenge.
Mm-hmm. So you taught literature for 40 years.
Yeah.
And so were you a early novel reader right from high school?
Well, I started reading a lot sooner than that.
Okay.
You waited to high school?
Well, I waited to high school, yeah.
No, I was fascinated with story. I think everyone, even if they're not acknowledging it, is fascinated with story very early on in life. I mean, it's how reality is presented to us initially.
Mm-hmm.
I probably started reading what you could call serious novels in middle school, and then more so in high school, of course, in college thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
So I've spent much of my life reading novels.
Yeah.
Not a bad gig.
That's not a bad gig at all. I was hearing a story of an author that was sort of in this dead-end job. It was early on in her career, and her friends all got together and said, look, we're gonna finance you for a year to not work and just to get in a room and write.
Yeah.
And that author was Harper Lee.
Oh, wonderful.
And this book she wrote was To Kill a Mockingbird.
Sure. Fantastic. See, I fantasized about having a group of friends like that for 40 years, and they never showed up.
Yeah. Bunch of deadbeat friends, huh?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Yeah. But, 50 million copies later.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, I often sell 50 copies
really?
Of my books.
Yeah, so it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm always encouraged when I talk to you because it's motivating to get out a pen and start writing stuff down or start to write reflections. Do you encourage people to start with a blog, or how do you get that pen going?
Well, if they're writing life stories, I suggest three lists. Start with lists before – never try to start with the first sentence of any story. That might be actually the last thing you write is the opening paragraph.
Okay.
And one list is events. And you just head that list the time that, and you just finish, just complete that sentence over the time that I fell off the horse, that I got caught cheating, the time that,
mm-hmm.
and you just make a list. And the second list is a values list. What are things that are really important to me? And it's not only the things that are ultimately important. For instance, a sense of humor mm-hmm. might be important to you. Well, nobody would say that's one of the three most important things in life. But you'd put that down, and you look at that values list. And then the third list, what is the third list?
I put pressure on you because we're out of time.
Oh, we're out of time.
Yeah,
okay.
that's the only...
And then basically you look at where those lists overlap, and that's where your best stories are.
That's awesome. Dr. Daniel Taylor's been my guest, and thank you so much for coming in.
It's really
great to see you. Yeah, we'll take a little break. We'll be back. Hour two has got Dr. John Woodward.